You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, in moments where we face deadlines and pressure, we often buckle down to get the job done. But a new exhibit of mid-century designers at the Milwaukee Art Museum suggests the best ideas are often found by making time for play. The curator of the new exhibit joins the show coming up. First, U.S. representatives from both parties voted last week to pass a reauthorization bill for the Federal Aviation Administration. The bill would continue funding for the FAA, but this year's version contains some new protections for airline passengers. If the bill becomes law, the FAA would be able to set a minimum standard for seat size and legroom on planes, and it would also prevent airlines, apparently, from forcibly removing passengers after they've cleared the boarding gate, something that got national attention last year after a man was dragged off a United Airlines flight to make room for crew members. Douglas Kidd is the executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. Douglas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this FAA reauthorization bill, it's huge. I understand 2,000 or so pages. There's a lot in there. But let's key in on this legroom thing, because this is a common problem faced by air travelers. Are things really getting more cramped over the years on the planes we fly on?
Yes, they are, and it's not an accident. The airlines have figured out that if, for example, they go from, say, 34 inches of legroom or seat pitch to 31 inches of seat pitch, they can put an extra row in the airplane for each 10 rows that they do that to. So they say, okay, this is basically free money. Let's put it in there. And, you know, people will, in most of the time, just simply accept it as it is. But, again, it's not really a good thing for passengers, because if you're on a short flight, okay, you can endure it. But the longer the flight is, the worse it gets. And, you know, there's potential for harm to people from blood clots and so forth.
So in this bill passed by the House, I think the Senate still has to weigh in on this. How would they regulate this issue of legroom and pitch?
Right. The Congress passes the law, but then it's up to the FAA or DOT in this case to create the regulation that enforces that particular part of the law. And before they do that, they've got to go through their own set of hearings and studies and so forth. So while we are glad that they're moving in this direction, this is something we asked the FAA and the to look into back in 2014, we're not going to hold our breath on this, because they're going to take their time, they're going to study it. They may come out with something that says to the effect that we don't see a problem with the existing standards. And what our main concern would be they would say, whatever it is right now is fine with us, rather than taking the passenger's point of view and saying 30 inches or less is unacceptable. We really need to go back to that 34-inch standard. And I'd say for some people, especially the people who are tall, they need even more than that.
One concern I've seen raised is that this might not just be a comfort issue if the legroom gets smaller and smaller. It could interfere with the ability to evacuate a plane quickly. Do you see that as a concern?
Well, I think so, because there's just no way that you can easily get out of a seat when you're packed in that tightly. The person on the aisle may be able to get out, but the person next to the window, he's got to wait for everybody else. Now, the FAA will tell you, okay, it can be done, but they do that a lot of times with computer simulations. They've stopped doing the live tests, and live tests don't always take into account that you've got people of all ages. You have men and women, you have children, you have the elderly, and in some cases you've got service animals in there as well. And so we think that this is something that they need to take a look at and say, okay, we don't want to overload the plane. We need to have enough room for everybody to move around freely and to be able to exit the plane expeditiously in case there is an emergency.
Talking to Douglas Kidd from the National Association of Airline Passengers, looking at the new FAA funding reauthorization bill and particular parts of it, especially as it relates to airline passengers. This other thing I mentioned in the setup there, it has to do with airlines forcibly removing passengers after they've boarded their plane. We mentioned that video last year, a man being dragged off a United flight. Why is this something that needs to be prohibited by law? How did we get here?
Well, actually, taking and dragging somebody off the plane for business purposes, in this case to make room for a some employees so they could fly, that was already illegal.
Oh, really?
That's why the airline settled it so quickly. The airlines do have the right to remove you if it is a safety issue. Okay? But in the case of Dr. David Dow, there was no safety issue involved. It was just, it was either give up your seat or else, and he said no, so he got the or else. And so when somebody took a look at this, they said, oh, my gosh, this is crazy. They actually engaged in a criminal act to remove him. So I'm glad that the FAA reauthorization bill just comes out and says, okay, you can't do this. You've already put the people on board the plane. This is no way to run a business. If there was a true emergency on board the plane, you can always empty the plane and then you can deal with it. Because when you put policemen or security people in there and they're going to forcibly remove somebody else in a different seat who had done nothing wrong could have also gotten hurt. And so this was really not good thinking on the part of the airline employees.
Is there anything else in this FAA bill that jumps out at you as something that could help passengers?
Well, one of the most important things that they've done in the bill is to give the flight attendants more rest. They're probably not getting enough rest as it is, but the improvement from 8 hours to 10 hours can really make a difference to the flight attendants who have to be at the flight early. They don't leave until everybody else is off the plane. Then they've got to get rest, and then they're going to do it all over again. Now, anybody else, when we leave work, we leave, at 6 o'clock, and we have to be back at work at, say, 9, we're going to get 12 hours of rest. But that flight attendant is not going to get that much. They'll get maybe 10, and probably less than that, because they've got to get to the hotel and everything else that's involved. So we want to see the flight attendants get as much rest as is necessary so they can do their job properly, because a tired flight attendant is, like anyone else, can make mistakes. She won't have the patience to deal with some of the passengers who have problems, who are not really a problem themselves, but they need her help or his help. So we want that flight attendant to be as well rested as possible. And so we're glad that they've taken a step in the right direction. They really need to get probably more than 10 hours. They probably need more than like 12, just like anyone else.
I could see the airline industry saying, okay, you can have these regulations. You can make it harder for us to fit more seats on a plane, maybe make us hire more flight attendants. That's going to show up in your airfare prices. This could raise costs. Is that a valid concern?
It is a valid concern, but only partially, because the passenger is going to pay for the conditions on the plane in one way or another. If you cramp the people into seats that are really too small, you could wind up paying for that with a blood clot that could kill you. If you have tired flight attendants, it could lead to confrontations on the plane that are completely unnecessary. If you have, other things happening on board the plane that says, okay, we just want to regard people as self-loading freight and pack as many of them in there as possible, that leads to other problems on the flight and becomes something to be endured rather than enjoyed. So you pay for it one way or the other. Our point of view is we would rather pay a little bit more and have a flight that where we're not cheek to jowl with our fellow passengers, where our knees are not in the other passenger's seat back, and where the flight attendants are not so tired that that they can't listen to our concerns or take care of us properly. We want the airlines, in other words, to serve us the way any other business would serve us. And if you think about it, would you ask a restaurant to say, oh, you only can give your employees 8 hours of rest between shifts? Nobody would think that would make any sense. Nobody would think that packing people into a place where they're uncomfortable would be good business. You want to make the passengers comfortable. You want to serve them properly with well-rested and people who are fresh and are capable of having and displaying a little bit of patience as they do their job. This is just common sense and something the airlines, have forgotten in their rush to make money. They've forgotten that there is a customer out there. It is a human being. And they need to be taken care of as human beings, and they're not just packages that to be thrown on board the plane and packed as tightly as possible.
We'll leave it there for now. Douglas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Douglas Kidd is Executive Director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. He joined us to talk about a bill passed by the U.S. House that, among other things, many other things, regulates legroom on planes and prohibits airlines from forcibly removing passengers once they've boarded for non-safety reasons. The FAA reauthorization bill is now headed to a vote in the U.S. Senate. New Milwaukee Art Museum exhibit suggests that serious work can still be fun. The new exhibit called Serious Play, Design in Mid-Century America includes furniture, toys, textiles, even playground equipment, all designed between the 1940s and 1960s with colorful tones and designs to sneak some playfulness into the lives of Americans. Monica Obniski is the Demmer Curator of 20th and 21st Century Design at the Milwaukee Art Museum. She helped curate and oversee the new exhibit co-organized with the Denver Art Museum. It opened last Friday. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as we walk into the exhibit, paint us a picture. What kind of things are we going to see?
Oh, my goodness. I have to say, this is probably the brightest, most colorful display that visitors will have seen at the Milwaukee Art Museum in the last few years. When you walk in, you enter into the first section of the exhibition, which is the American home. So we explore whimsical product design and other things that may be found in the domestic sphere. Visitors then move into child's play, and visitors can see examples of works done for small scale, so children's furniture, architect design toys, as well as playgrounds and play equipment. And the last section of the exhibition focuses on corporate approaches, so things that were embraced by corporations in the mid-century that looked playful and whimsical.
Now, people might think back in the 1950s, and maybe the word conformity might pop into their head. Everybody's wearing the same suit. You've got cookie-cutter houses. But clearly, people in the design world were trying to do something different. Can you talk about that moment and what the designers were doing?
Yeah, you've actually hit it on the head. I mean, one of the things that I like to talk about is, you know, the man in the gray flannel suit, and that is exactly it, right? This kind of homogenous 1950s moment. And there were a lot of architects and designers who were really striving to get away from that. And so this is what we've done in this exhibition, is we've looked at a number of these architects and designers, over 40 of them, who have tried to get away from this anti-homogenous society and move towards something that was a little bit more whimsical and playful, you know, in order to get at solutions, to encourage free play. I mean, there were a lot of kind of outcomes.
And as I understand it, if I read this right, there are some artifacts from that era, but there's also some modern things inspired by that. Is that right?
No, actually, everything in the exhibition is from the period. So it's all 1940s through the late 1960s, with the exception of we do have three play areas in which people are encouraged to walk in and actually play with things that were made yesterday, which is why they are allowed to touch those things. So I think maybe that's what you're referring to, are these play areas.
And there's a philosophy here that I think you are interested in, and these designers were, the idea that good, cool stuff can come out of having fun with it instead of coming in with this very serious approach.
Yeah, totally. So I think, you know, when people stop and think about what the furniture from the period looks like, you might think about something that is, you know, made of new materials or new technologies, something like the Eames of plywood, for example. That seems pretty ubiquitous now. But in the period, it really comes out of a lot of experimentation that they do. And so in the exhibition, we have a number of examples from the Eameses, but one that I'll call your attention to is a small child's chair. So they made children's furniture in the late 1940s, and actually it was while they were experimenting with their full-size plywood chairs that they decided to try to make the small-scale children's furniture. And so it really gets back at this, at our central thesis, which is, you know, through experimentation or play, it's possible for designers to come up with so many different kind of positive outcomes. And through iteration, you really get at different, different objects.
You mentioned the Eameses, and as I understand it, they and some of these other designers, they didn't just work on one kind of thing. They weren't just, I do chairs, or I do rooms, or something like that. A lot of them were experimenting in a lot of different, mediums and forms.
Yeah, so we. What's interesting is if you come to the exhibition, you'll actually be able to see that. So the Eameses are the kind of quintessential example. So you'll see work from them that includes films and furniture and also toys for children. And I think this is important because it really it really shows people that architecture and design is not just, you know, it's not just a singular discipline, but in fact, once you start blurring the boundaries, you can do super interesting things. And it's not just the Eameses. There were a number of designers that that worked across many different disciplines. I think one great example is someone like Ann Ting, who's best known as an architect, but the project that we are highlighting in the exhibition is actually her first project before she began making buildings, and that was a Ting toy. And it was this interesting modular toy that was essentially a kind of kit of parts, and kids and adults could make anything from like a push cart to a table to, you know, whatever it is that your imagination allowed you to do. And what's important about this is that even in the period, she said that it was this project that allowed her to do something playful and that allowed her to develop her ideas. So play for the idea of play is really important because it gets architects and designers thinking about other projects.
We're talking to Monica Obniski. She's with the Milwaukee Art Museum, curator of a new exhibit there, Serious Play, Design in Mid-Century America, just opened up, running for another bunch of months there. And Monica, is this just kind of a novelty dead end in the history of design, or do the things these designers you're featuring did back, you know, in the 1950s still echo today?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're seeing, you know, one of the things that people ask me about is, oh, you know, this seems like it's super popular now and there must be a reason. And I think, actually, I think in terms of its aesthetic, it has been popular for a little while. But I think in terms of its ideas, right, this idea that free play or experimentation is really central to the work of architects and designers. I mean, if you look at something like Silicon Valley, for example, I mean, they are really kind of driving this message home. And so I think certainly the topic does, is really important for corporations today. So I think we're seeing some of these trends continue.
Right. I've talked to a lot of guests who say one of the key skills, I guess, one of the key competencies of an employee is creativity, and worries that maybe we're focusing too much on, you know, rigid facts, math education, stuff like that, and not nurturing the creativity enough. Is that a worry you have as you look at the designs here?
Yeah, I think actually that's exactly what these architects and designers were getting at. You know, just to give another example from the exhibition, another architect that we feature, his name is Arthur Carrara, and he practiced in Chicago, but he actually also had a lot of connections to Wisconsin. One of the projects that we look at is his Magnet Masters, which was a toy that he made for a museum in Minneapolis in the 1940s, and you think, okay, well, this is just a silly thing, right? It's a bunch of shapes, colors, and he's employing magnets and asking children and adults to make things out of these shapes and magnets. But actually, he was thinking about magnetism as not just something that was a playful game, but he was thinking about magnets for future buildings, and he was trying to kind of get, he was actually envisioning a future in which buildings could be held together by a powerful magnetic core. And it's only when you allow yourself to stop and dream and think about these things that, you know, the future is possible. I mean, and we can even think about something like, you know, Tesla or, you know, going to, you know, when we talk about, you know, regular civilians going to the moon, right? I mean, this kind of thing wouldn't be possible 50 years ago if it weren't for, you know, a designer's vision.
What are you hoping, maybe the non-professional designers who visit the exhibit, what are you hoping they're inspired to do when they leave?
Well, I hope that they come through, see a bunch of really beautiful things that inspire them, you know, in their own lives. I hope that they take some time to actually explore the play areas and, again, let their minds go free and maybe, you know, spin a top. You maybe haven't spun a top since you were 7, but, you know, just to kind of enjoy the process of doing that. And I hope that actually it gives you some pause and it causes you to think that, oh, maybe I should block out 15 minutes a day to not read something or not look at email or not look at my screen and actually just let my mind go. I think that would be the greatest thing.
Are there a couple artifacts in the exhibit that you'd want us to maybe pause by for a few extra minutes and really take in and be inspired by?
Oh my gosh, there are
so
way too many things for me. I don't want to tell you how many objects are in the show because I don't want to scare you. But I believe that this is a show in which there is a little bit of something for everyone. And as I've gone through and I've watched people, you know, pause at, for example, there's a beautiful installation of mid-century clocks. There are 10 clocks that were most of them designed by Irving Harper for George Nelson. One of them by Lucia de Respines for George Nelson. Produced by the Howard Miller Clock Company. And these are just super fun, super whimsical. And the way that they're installed, causes people to kind of stop, take a photograph, you know, maybe say like, oh, I remember seeing this in Grandma's house. I think that there are a lot of really beautiful moments like that throughout the exhibition.
And do you think maybe somebody will see these and we'll see a new clock or piece of furniture or what have you in 10, 15 years inspired by what they saw there?
Fingers crossed. I mean, I would love for there to be some young designers in Milwaukee that are going through and that they're inspired by something that they see. That would be really wonderful.
Monica, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Monica Obniski is the Demmer Curator of 20th and 21st Century Design at the Milwaukee Art Museum. She helped curate and oversee this new exhibit we've been talking about, Serious Play Design in Mid-Century America. It's co-organized with the Denver Art Museum. The exhibit is open now through January 6th. By the way, there's a gallery talk with Monica tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. at the museum. Check mam.org for more dates. Follow-up research to the 2016 Wisconsin Poverty Report has found that Milwaukee County still has the highest poverty rate in the state. The poverty rate statewide currently hovers around 11%, but in Wisconsin's most populous county, it's creeping up toward 18%. Our next guest is here to talk about the report, what it means for Milwaukee County and the state as a whole. Tim Smeeting is with us now. He's the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, we've talked to you about the statewide poverty report, and it looks like in this new follow-up with Milwaukee County, Milwaukee County really stands out in the state when it comes to poverty.
Yeah, well, when we did the report, we found there was a lot of good news. There were 29 separate counties in the state that were below average. All the rest were average, but there was one stubbornly pulling everything up and significantly so, and that was Milwaukee. So we said, let's take a look at Milwaukee. And if you're going to look at Milwaukee and you're going to look on poverty, we need to look at race and ethnicity too. So that's what we did.
And now, before we dig into the details within Milwaukee County, is this something we've been seeing over the years, that Milwaukee County stands out with the highest poverty rates?
Yes, we've seen this for a long time. There have been other areas during the Great Recession where poverty was almost as high, but Milwaukee is consistently long-term high poverty, particularly in the central city, but also in the rest of the county. It's the most segregated county and city in the country. And so we know race has something to do with it. It consistently shows up in the Casey Kids Count. When you find black kids in Milwaukee and you compare them to white kids, the differential between the two is the biggest in the country, or the second biggest almost every year.
So take us inside Milwaukee County. You were able to break it down in eight regions within the county, and even there. So we were talking at the state level. There's this huge variety in poverty rates. Digging in deeper, when we look at Milwaukee County, there's a lot of variation there too.
Yeah, in Milwaukee, there are 18 census areas which have at least 100,000 people in them, and the samples are big enough to dig inside. So we can look at the variance within the county, and the variance is huge. It goes from, 30 and 40 and higher in the middle to 4 and 5% in the suburbs within the same county. You don't have to go to Waukesha, Ozaukee, Jefferson within the county.
So let's talk about that, 30 to 40% poverty rates in one region within the city of Milwaukee, it looks like, looking at your maps. And that's huge. That really stands out.
It varies a lot by area and by race, although whites who are in heavily black areas also don't do very well. It reflects the segregation within the city, the spatial segregation. It reflects incarceration. It reflects bad schools. It reflects lack of good jobs, and it reflects, family structure, which is affected by, clearly, by imprisonment and lack of jobs and so forth.
Are there areas within Milwaukee where black people in particular have significantly lower poverty rates than that 30 to 40%?
It's in some of the near areas, yes. But it's hard. The poverty rates will go down some, but it's hard to find enough blacks in those areas. Mm-hmm. In some, we had absolutely none in our sample. But, you know, the example, it's similar to Madison, where people were be stuck out in the north side, moved to Sun Prairie or somewhere. They moved out. But in Milwaukee, they're stuck there. They haven't moved to Brown Deer or Cedarburg or to, or south even, to other outlying areas.
So there's racial segregation, as you were mentioning, and economic segregation as well. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, part of the issue is that if you have a low-income group just pushed in one place, there aren't any jobs around. Half of the African-American men in Milwaukee have some sort of a criminal record that makes it much harder to get a job, any kind of job. The good jobs are in the periphery. You need to get out there. If you have children, you need child care to someone to take care of your kids. So this makes it, and not to mention the violence and the trauma that's there. So this makes it very difficult to lead a normal life and normal economic life. And most people would like to move if they could afford to. So my student, Matt Desmond, wrote a famous book called Evicted. And Matt said, you know, in Central City, Milwaukee, people are paying 40 and 50% of their incomes for rent. But the Wisconsin Policy Forum just did a lovely report. It's not because rents are high or homes aren't available. It's because incomes are so darn low. So I'll give you one number. This is a great guess number. Suppose I ask you the following. Within Milwaukee County, what fraction of black families with children were living with incomes above twice the poverty line, meaning above $40,000 or $50,000? The answer is 1 in 8 only. So if you pick a black kid out, there's a 7/8 chance that they're either poor or near poor, and they're not doing well in school, they're stuck in those Central City schools, they don't have alternatives, the families can't move out to avoid the violence and to improve the schools and things for their kids. So that's a problem. If we're going to solve poverty in the state of Wisconsin, we have to pay attention to Milwaukee.
Talking to Tim Smeeting from UW-Madison, looking at a new report on poverty rates in Milwaukee County in particular. Tim, I'm hearing a whole bunch of kind of chicken or egg type questions. There aren't jobs. But job creators aren't going to want to move into this area if they don't feel like it's safe, if there's not opportunities there to sell things to people. That's just one of the where do you start type questions.
Well, you need to get the people to the jobs, and the jobs are on the periphery, or even the jobs are in the infrastructure we're building up for Foxconn and everything. Those jobs do not require high levels of education. Those are the sorts of jobs that if you're really desperate and needed someone for a job, an employer could take someone, a formerly incarcerated person, and give them a chance working in a construction crew. In fact, I don't see why that doesn't happen. But, you know, this has been terrible because the blame game has been going on in Milwaukee for a long, long time. The Democrats know better than the Republicans. The mayor has been sitting on this for as long as he's been mayor and before that. And somebody needs to get off the dime and make some changes. There has to be some policy. Employers, if they're hungry for people and they want to give people a second chance, the way they are doing here in Madison, you need to go offer jobs to people. Give them a chance. The state could subsidize them, give them a few dollars off an hour for training purposes, and give them a bonus if they're still working in 6 months or something. That would be one nice way of injecting some money into downtown. Of course, you'd have to get them out to the jobs. But employer Uber, there's ways of getting people to the jobs if employers are as hungry as some people think they are.
Is there a need for subsidies for transportation like that, as you say, to get from, say, the Central City
sure.
to jobs on the periphery?
Look in this town. You see all those red vans driving around? Those are all those state vans. When I was running the Poverty Institute, I had 6 people here for me who were in Janesville and Beloit. They get in a van every afternoon and go back. Why can't there be a van somewhere in downtown Milwaukee that picks guys up at 6:30 or 7 in the morning, takes them out to the job, and brings them back after? That's a low cost if that's what an employer wants and if they need that labor. And, I mean, this is all mixed up in race, too, in racial politics. We know you can find white formerly incarcerated men on the front page of the New York Times walking out of prison into a job in Stoughton Trailer. But I can't get any data from the state on how well we're doing with African-American men on that same, and keeping them from going back to prison and getting them jobs.
Is this not a priority because this is a primarily black area we're talking about?
It could be. I mean, a lot of people have a reaction to black men that they're scary. They've been in prison, which a lot of them have. Some who are violent should be in prison. They shouldn't be out. But young first-time offenders, if we could divert them to something other than prison, if we could start get them involved in jobs, if we could give them an opportunity. And the same thing now, next fall with single parents, they're going to say, if you're so low income, you're still receiving our food share program, you have to go out and work 30 hours a week. Well, where's the child care? Where's the transportation? Who's going to give them a chance? Is there a transition job you can go to? So one of our former students, Johnny Hunter here, who runs one of the local food cooperatives, Underground Butcher, he and his colleagues set up a bakery, Sunshine Bakery, which gives people a chance to learn how to be bakers and then places them in jobs in the restaurant industry and the bakery industry in this town. We need more and more things like that. We really need to try. And the same, obviously, for mothers with kids who also need the help directly themselves.
Now, the way you measure poverty is a little different than the way the feds do. You include the impact of public assistance programs in that. And you just mentioned the possibility of work requirements for public assistance. Are there ways we could do public assistance better that'll create better incentives in, say, that 30 to 40% poverty rate area?
Sure. First of all, we could have a higher minimum wage, not $15, but not $7.25. We could go to $9 or $10, which is what we've done. That gives you an incentive to go out to work because you'll get more.
Okay, I'm going to stop you at minimum wage. If I don't want to start a business in central Milwaukee paying the current minimum wage, why do I want to start one paying a higher minimum wage?
No. I don't want you to start a business there. I want to get the people out to the businesses.
Okay.
I mean, there are ways of trying to stimulate business in Milwaukee, but business in those areas of Milwaukee is expensive. I've been to those areas. They have to rent. They have rent guards at the front and the back door, and people are afraid to go there at night and things like that. So if we can't fix that area directly, the trick is to give people enough economic wherewithal that they can move out of there. So expanded low-income housing would help too, but that's expensive more generally.
All right, but how about once people start getting money, is there a way we can make the community something that they don't want to move out of once they can afford to?
That would be wonderful. That takes leadership within the community. It takes policing the streets. It would take continuing to reduce crime. It's just very difficult. Reducing unplanned pregnancies would be good so that young women and men who did not want to have a baby didn't have an accident and have a baby, which if you don't have your education or a job, that creates, a really steep row to hoe. If you haven't finished your education, you don't have a job, you don't have a partner, and you don't have a plan, it's hard to raise that kid in a non-poverty situation, and then it hurts the employment situation of the mother and the father may end up in jail. So one of the things that we do know that works, though, is allowing people who are scared or afraid to move out of the city into a different area. And if we could do more of that, that would help. And one way to do it is if people could earn some money and get their earned income tax credit, when they get it once a month, you have first and last month's rent, that could allow you to move, okay? If we had a child allowance in our country like other, if we took the child tax credit of $2,000 a year, which I get and most other parents do, and paid it monthly and made it refundable, that'd be $170 a month check that per kid that every mother would get. And they could use that to help enhance the education of their children, maybe find a private school, a Catholic school, some other school, but also to not worry about whether you have to choose between the car or the rent and so forth every month.
Talking to Tim Smeeting, professor of public affairs and economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, with us to talk about a recent report looking at poverty rates in Milwaukee County. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You've heard some of Tim's suggestions. What do you think? What questions do you have about poverty in Milwaukee County? What should local leaders, the state government, do to try to tackle this problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Especially like to hear from you if you are in Milwaukee County seeing this firsthand. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about poverty rates in Milwaukee County. Tim Smeeting is with us, professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This new report shows significantly higher levels of poverty in Milwaukee County, especially in some areas in the city of Milwaukee. What do you think? What should local government, the state, do to alleviate poverty around Wisconsin, especially in Milwaukee County? Are you living there right now? What do you see around you? Any signs of hope? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We heard from Ralph in Milwaukee, who asks what the state, Tim, has done with shared revenue in the past decade. So there's that kind of complicated formula when it comes to funding local governments. What do you see from the state in funding what's going on in Milwaukee County?
Well, I'm not too familiar with that, I must say. But as far as I know, I mean, that isn't really going to help. And then it's a county priority. Where do you put those shared revenues? And how much of those shared revenues actually go into areas which need it? And what do you do there? And I'm honestly with you, I don't know. But there hasn't been much effect, whatever they've been doing. They have to do something different. That's the point.
Let's go to our callers now. Ryan is with us in Glendale in Milwaukee County. Ryan, hello.
Hello. Hey, so I have a great discussion, by the way. I have a question. I have a friend who is from a nearby to me, because as you say, or as you mentioned, this county is very segregated. And I have a friend nearby to me who I've been kind of helping out, and he got a job, $15.50, out in Heartland. They are transporting him out there. But, you know, after a couple weeks, he got really discouraged because the drive was really long, and then a family member spent all of his income at the casino, and it was really discouraging for him, and he quit his job after 2 weeks. I'm just wondering, like, are almost everybody who gets these opportunities ready to go and get this work, and what's gonna sustain the population to be able to really have that encouragement to just keep going and get over some of those humps? You know what I mean?
Ryan, thanks a lot. So some obstacles, even when you can find a job, Tim, can you talk about that generally?
Thanks, Ryan. You're right. It isn't just the transportation. It's sticking with it. It's being able to manage your money when you've got it and not let a family member gamble it away, obviously. It is a little bit longer. You know, it might take an hour to get out there or back. But, you know, for something that pays $15.50 an hour, that's full-time, that's $30,000 a year. That's better than you had before. And maybe you can find a job closer, and maybe you can raise enough money that you can move out closer there and still in a reasonable place. But we have to work on these things, Ryan. You're totally right. And for guys who've been in prison, the problems are even worse. So it needs some support services and social help too. But God bless you for helping your friend, because, you know, if you can't live there, you have to go where the jobs are.
Ryan, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Andrea in Green Bay. Andrea, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to call in and talk about how I grew up in Milwaukee and recently moved from there to the Green Bay area for a new job, and just how there aren't any good jobs down there. There's a lot of low-paying service jobs, and I graduated from college in the middle of the recession and just couldn't find anything. And it took me, I'm 29 now, but finally found my first real job I can support myself on, but had to leave the area to do so.
Do you regret having to leave the area, Andrea, to do that?
In some ways I do. All my family is down there, but crime was just getting worse, and housing was just getting terribly expensive. I was lucky that I could live with my parents. It was the only way I could make it. You know, I found some temp work, some part-time work, but nothing that I could support myself on.
Andrea, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. I heard she's not alone in this story. I know, Tim. That housing, again. So you'd think with high poverty, you'd have a lot of lower income housing. But as you were saying earlier, and Andrea's saying, still not necessarily stuff you can afford on a low income.
It may be, and it may not have been, you know, for someone like Andrea, it may not have been safe either. I mean, that's a concern. But according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, there are places that are available and places you can rent, but you do need a job to do that. And if you can't find anything, couldn't find anything in the suburbs, Green Bay is bouncing right along. But you did have to leave your family, Andrea. But part of the problem is there aren't enough people like you who can move or are willing to move. Even you're a college graduate. Imagine if you're trying to do this with, you know, nothing but a high school degree or maybe not even that. And that, you know, you needed training for skills. You needed an employer to give you an apprenticeship and so forth. It wasn't easy when you moved, but now supposedly unemployment is really low all over the state. The governor is going to push single parents to work 30 hours a week because we need more workers in Wisconsin and so forth and so on. Why don't employers get involved and say, this is what we need, and say we're willing, you know, help us find the right people and we'll give them a job.
Andrea, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Rich in Madison. Rich, hello.
Hi. I had a question and maybe a suggestion of ways we could rally the community, in particular community leaders, to kind of help sponsor and train the youth to kind of go down a better path and maybe get them towards jobs, and then maybe start like a community garden where they can then grow produce and then sell it in a farmer's market, or even start their own farmer's market.
Gotcha. Rich, I'm going to jump in because we're low on time. I've talked to people who are doing these things, Tim, exactly the stuff Rich is talking about, and I've heard from a lot of them, we're doing our piece of the puzzle, they're doing their piece. There's no wider coordination of all these efforts to bring them all together.
It is difficult, and social service agencies are playing the biggest role. Or people, like I said, Johnny Hunter at Underground Butcher, who they went up and they set up a bakery and they trained people in the bakery. I support them. I give them money because it's what you need. And some people, they haven't worked before very much. They need job-ready skills and things like that. And farming is a great idea, but that's seasonal. And in the winter, you can bake all the time. But Rich, I think in general, you got the right idea. It takes a village, and it will take a village. And in Madison, poverty isn't so concentrated. You're closer to jobs, and there are more opportunities. I mean, the place is booming. So I think it would, keeping going with what we're doing and hoping to make a dent at some point would be a great thing. But thanks for your call.
Rich, yeah, thanks for calling in. And Tim, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you again, Rob.
That's Tim Smeeting. He's the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Been talking to us about poverty rates in Milwaukee County, a new report on that, and some of the steps the state, the communities can take to alleviate poverty. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Trump administration report says global temperatures will increase by 7 degrees by the end of the century, but advises against particular actions to fight that increase. We'll dig into the issue and the potential impact of policy changes. We'll take a tour of mail order houses in Wisconsin and beyond and look at the rise and fall of these homes that were delivered by train, some assembly required. And how do you make the biggest decisions in your life? The author of the new book, Farsighted, gives us some strategies for choosing a new path at the next turning point in our lives. That's tomorrow on Central Time.